From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, one of the true eccentrics of pop music, Tom Waits. He'll tell us why, when he was a young man, he wanted to look and sound like an old man. He has a new CD titled Real Gone. And as we head into the second presidential debate tonight, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how we viewed the first one. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Today's weak jobs report is likely to be a major topic at tonight's presidential debate in St. Louis. The Labor Department reported that businesses added just 96,000 jobs in September. That's less than most economists had been predicting, and it leaves President Bush with a net loss of just under 600,000 jobs since he took office. Democratic challenger John Kerry said the figures show that the president's economic policies are failing to produce jobs.
Tonight, I look forward to talking to America about how we can have a better plan to put Americans back to work and to create better jobs for our country. That's what America deserves, and that's what it's going to get.
The Bush campaign has focused on job growth over the past year and on the fact that the unemployment rate remained at 5.4% last month. That's below the historic average. The House of Representatives passed an intelligence reform bill today by a vote of 282 to 134. The bill is significantly different from the Senate version, NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Nearing the end of congressional business before the election, Republican House leaders hailed the passage of intelligence reform legislation. Ohio Congresswoman Deborah Price is a leading Republican.
Of all the accomplishments that we've made this year, today's bill is perhaps the most important because it closes loopholes, it corrects mistakes, and bolsters our defense to prevent the one event that left its ugly mark on this generation from ever happening again.
But many Democrats and 9/11 victims' families blamed the House Republicans with injecting angry partisanship into the reform process. House and Senate leaders will try to resolve the differences between their two versions of the legislation. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, the Capitol.
According to documents filed in federal court today, the government has two primary principles, but no hard and fast rules for deciding who will be barred from boarding airliners. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The secret no-fly list names passengers who should either be barred from getting on an airplane or be subject to extra screening. According to documents, many heavily edited, there were 16 names on the list before the September 11th terrorist attacks. That number grew to about 600 names a few months later. The government would not divulge how many people are on the list now. But one document, a report by the General Accounting Office, revealed that there are two key guidelines for placing someone on the list. One is whether intelligence agents view the individual as a threat to civil aviation. The other is whether the agency has provided enough information to identify the person who's to be flagged at the check-in counter. The documents also disclose that people are regularly removed from the list if the FBI feels they are no longer a threat. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow was down 70 to 10,055, the NASDAQ down 28 to 1920. This is NPR News. A former NASA worker denies that he falsified safety inspections on the Space Shuttle Discovery. Billy Thornton was arraigned today in federal court in Orlando. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
Billy Thornton chose to plead not guilty rather than take a plea deal from prosecutors where he would admit to a single count of fraud. The former NASA inspector now faces over 160 felony counts. Thornton oversaw inspections of electronics and structural parts on Shuttle Discovery during a major overhaul. The spaceship hasn't flown since August 2001. It was taken out of the flight rotation after that mission for refurbishment, supervised in part by Thornton. Later in 2003, all of NASA's shuttles were grounded following the loss of Columbia. Prosecutors say the inspections Thornton is accused of faking include checks of parts vital to the safe flight of the Space Shuttle Discovery. It's scheduled to make the first launch since the Columbia disaster, perhaps next spring or summer. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins, Orlando.
The family of British hostage Kenneth Bigley says he was beheaded by his captors. Bigley's brother Philip said the family has received absolute proof of the hostage's death, and he added that family members believe the British government had done everything it could to gain Bigley's release. But another of Bigley's brothers, Paul, blamed the British government and said Prime Minister Tony Blair had blood on his hands. Bigley's kidnappers had demanded that the U.S.-led command in Iraq release all Iraqi women it has arrested. British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw said the British government exchanged messages with Bigley's captors, saying it agreed to talk with the kidnappers but refused to pay a ransom or to give in to their demands. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 8 points to close at 1,122. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Travelocity, providing more than 35,000 customer reviews on hotels worldwide. Online at Travelocity.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Tom Waits is one of the true eccentrics of pop music. There's always been an element of mystery surrounding his life. The people he sings about usually are outsiders, outlaws, drunks, hobos, and losers.
He had three old dollars, one out car, a wife who was leaving for good. Life's made of trouble, worry, pain, and struggle. She wrote goodbye in the dust on the hood. We found a map of Missouri, lipstick on a glass. They must have left in the middle of the night. And I want to know the same thing everyone wants to know. How's it gone? She sunk like a hammer into the lake. Long lost letter in an old leaky boat. Promises I never meant to keep. I want to know the same thing. I want to know how's it gone.
That's How's It Gonna End from the new Tom Waits recording, Real Gone. The darkness of his lyrics is enhanced by the rumble and rasp of his voice, a voice that sounded old even when he was young. Waits has been recording since 1973. His songs have been used on the soundtracks of several films, and he's acted in the movies Down by Law, Shortcuts, Wolfen, Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, and Coffee and Cigarettes. Terry spoke with Tom Waits in 2002.
The arrangements for your songs are really good. Do you do the arrangements yourself?
Well, I collaborate with my wife on the songs, and every aspect of it, really, from composing and arranging and recording, all that business. So, you know, we have a rhythm and a way of working it. It's kind of like borrowing the same $10 from somebody over and over again. But, you know, when you live together, you know, it makes it a lot easier, the payback, you know.
What came first to you, for you, being married or being song collaborators?
I guess, I don't know. It seemed like, you know, we started working together right after we got married, I think. And we got, actually, yeah, my wife had $50 on her, and I had $20. When we got married, and it was a $70 wedding, so I actually thought this is not a good way to start. But we got married about 1 o'clock in the morning out in Watts, and it was kind of a whirlwind thing, and the preacher was on a beeper. And it, you know, worked out. You know, sometimes I had, you know, really expensive weddings only last a couple of weeks. It worked, yeah.
So you weren't already writing songs when you got together?
Oh, well, I was, yeah.
No, the two of you, I mean, collaborating.
No, not really. No, we only know each other a short time when we got married. You know, we didn't really have any time to write any songs. We just kind of swooped down and then we did it.
It worked, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
You got a wife and a songwriting partner.
Yeah, right.
It's a good deal.
Yeah, it was a good deal. Yeah, and when you collaborate, sometimes it's somewhat of a quarrel, but I think that it is good. I think it keeps you away from the emperor's new clothes or whatever. Someone to check into with that you trust, you know. It's been really good for both of us.
Do you think it's changed your style of songwriting, either changed the music itself or changed the process of writing the music to collaborate?
Mm. Well, I don't know. I can run things by her, and she said, "Well, that's a lot of hogwash. You've been doing that for years," or you know, that's really corny or that's really cliche, or yeah, it's good. Yeah, so. We kind of sharpen each other like knives, and it seems to work out like that.
Some of your music writing seems influenced by the German songs of Kurt Weill. Have you listened a lot to him? Do you feel like he's influenced your writing?
Well, you know, I hadn't really listened to him until I had people tell me that I sounded somewhat like him or had some influence in there. So I said, well, I better start listening to this stuff.
What'd you think?
I liked it. It's really, a lot of it's really angry, and I guess I like beautiful melodies telling me terrible things.
Small put, yeah.
So it works for me. Yeah.
What was the music that you grew up listening to because your parents were listening to it? I mean, before you were old enough to choose music yourself, mm-hmm. What was the music in your house?
Really young mariachi music, I guess. My dad only played a Mexican radio station, and then Frank Sinatra, and later Harry Belafonte, and then I would go over to my friends' houses, and I would go into the den with their dads and find out what they were listening to. That's what I was really. I couldn't wait to be an old man. I was about 13. You know, I didn't really identify with the music of my own generation, but I was very curious about the music of others. And I think I responded to the song forms themselves. You know, cakewalks and waltzes and mm-hmm. barcaroles and parlor songs and all that stuff. Which are just really nothing more than jello molds for music. but I seem to like the old stuff, Cole Porter and, Oscars and Hammerstein and Gershwin, all that stuff. I like the melody.
So when you were 13, being more interested in the music of your parents, your friend's parents and in your friend's music, what was the music of your generation that didn't interest you?
You know, like the Strawberry Alarm Clock or
right.
But later I liked that stuff, you know, like the Animals and Blue Cheer and, Led Zeppelin and all that stuff and the Yardbirds and, of course, Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Bob Dylan. James Brown, I was really, really hot on James Brown.
What did you hear in them later that you didn't hear when you were in your early teens?
I don't know. Maybe I felt like it was safe to go in and listen to it now that it had been there for a while or something. I don't know. I think when you're a teenager, that music is really kind of like a collared shirt or a watch or. It seems more of an accessory, you know, a certain level.
Or a badge of identity.
Yeah, you're making a remark about yourself as to what you listen to, and I think that part bugged me. And so it kind of kept me from really listening to it just as music. You know,
Now, you said your father listened mostly to the Mexican station and to mariachi music.
Yeah.
Was your father Mexican?
No, my dad's from Texas. He grew up in a place called Sulphur Springs, Texas. And my mom's from Oregon. She listened to church music, you know, all that, Brother Springer, all those. She used to send money into all the preachers, you know. And but the early songs I remember was Abilene. When I heard Abilene on the radio, it really moved me. And then I heard, Abilene, prettiest town I've ever seen. Women there don't treat you mean. And Abilene, I just thought that was the greatest lyric. You know, women there don't treat you mean. And then Detroit City. Last night I went to sleep in Detroit City. And I dreamed about the cotton fields back home. I liked songs with the names of towns in them, and mm-hmm. I think I liked songs with weather in them, and something to eat. So I feel like there's a certain anatomical aspect to a song that I respond to. I think, oh, yeah, I can go into that world. There's something to eat. There's the name of a street. There's a saloon. Okay. So I think probably that's why I put things like that in my songs.
Tom Waits, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. His new CD is called Real Gone. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Tom Waits. She spoke with him in 2002 after the release of his CDs Alice and Blood Money.
You know how you said when you're in your early teens, music is almost like a certain type of collar or a certain type of accessory? When you started listening to older music and relating to that, did other things accompany that, like a certain way of dressing or speaking or behaving?
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, I wore an old hat and I drove an old car. I bought a car for $50 from Fred Moody next door, who's from Tennessee. 55 Buick Special, and, you know, to get AM radio in there. I guess, yeah, sure. You know, I walked with a cane. You know, I was really, I was going overboard perhaps, but.
What kind of cane is it?
You know, a cane.
Like, no, I mean, did it have like a silver tip? I mean, how?
No, an old man's cane from a Salvation Army.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I carved my name in it and everything.
And what did you think that added to your image?
It gave me a walk, I guess.
Uh-huh,
gave me something distinctive. Oh, what was that guy in here earlier with a cane? Did you see that guy? It just gave me something that I liked, identity-wise, I guess.
I want to play another track from Blood Money, and this is called A Good Man Is Hard to Find. This is Tom
sure.
Waits.
Well, I always play Russian roulette in my head. 17 black, 429 red. How far from the pew, I will always remember to forget about you. Good man is hard to find, won't let strangers sleep in my bed.
I want to ask you about your voice. You have a very raspy singing voice. Was that a sound that you strove for? You know, that you worked on having, or was it what naturally developed?
It's that old man thing. I couldn't wait to be an old man. Old man with a deep voice. I scream into a pillow.
Well, you know, John Mahoney, the actor?
Sure, yeah.
He told me he actually did stuff like that, wanted a distinctive voice. And and so he used to do these exercises that he practiced in a closet of just, like, shouting and trying to, you know, like, growl a lot. And he actually permanently did something to his vocal cords as a result of it.
Yeah, hooray. I'm all for it.
was say, Louis Armstrong an influence on you?
Oh, God, yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, you can't ignore the influence of someone like Louis Armstrong. It's he's like a river. He's like a country to be explored in and of himself. And he was like he came out of the ground just like a potato. You know, he's completely natural. I love those tunes. And but this one, this Good Man's Hard to Find, was an attempt to kind of tip my hat somewhat to that.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you ever worried about hurting your voice by?
Oh, I've heard it. Yeah, I have heard it. But I have a voice doctor in New York who used to treat Frank Sinatra and various people. He said, "Oh, you're doing fine. Don't worry about it."
That's good. Now, you once said that you wish you could have been a part of the Brill Building era in which people like Carole King and Lee Bernstoller and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry were writing songs for singers and for vocal groups. What do you think you would have liked about that?
Oh, I guess writing at gunpoint sounds really exciting to me. Those kinds of deadlines. I'm into a rehearsal building on Times Square in New York one afternoon, and a really tiny little room. In fact, it was probably smaller than the room I'm in right now, which is a little larger than a phone booth. There's just enough room for a little spinet piano, and then you could just barely close the door, and there you were. And it was, and you could hear every kind of music coming to you through the walls and through the windows and underneath the door. And you heard African bands, and you heard, like, comedians, and you hear applause every now and then, and you hear tap dancers, and I think I just like the whole melange of it, the way it all kind of mixes together. Mm-hmm. I like turning on two radios at the same time and listening to them. I like hearing things incorrectly. I think that's how I get a lot of ideas, is by mishearing something.
Although you weren't part of the Brill Building thing, other people have recorded your songs, and I thought I'd play one of them. Johnny Cash recorded your song "Down There by the Train."
Yeah, all right, that killed me. That was wild. I said, "That's it. I'm all done now." Boy, Johnny Cash did a song on my boy. I'm all done. Thanks very much. that was really flattering. I love the way he did it, too.
Oh, yeah. Do you know how he knew the song or why he decided to record it?
Well, a lot of people sent him tunes because he's doing this record with Rick Rubin and different people that different songwriters sent him tunes, and then he just picked from them. So I didn't know if he was going to do it or not. I figured, well, I hadn't done it. I don't know why I hadn't done it. I don't remember who. So I didn't really know until I heard the record came out. It was like, wow, that's great. When someone does a tune, well, especially someone that you've been listening to since you're a kid, it's a bit of a validation. It's meaningful.
Yeah, Johnny Cash is pretty validating when it comes to that.
Yeah, all right.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is from Johnny Cash's American Recordings album, and this is the Tom Waits song, "Down There by the Train."
You can hear the whistle, you can hear the bell, from the halls of heaven to the gates of hell, and there's room for the forsaken if you're there on time. You'll be washed of all your sins and all of your crimes.
if you're down there by the train, 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 down there where the train goes slow.
That's Johnny Cash doing the Tom Waits song, Down There by the Train. My guest is Tom Waits. Did you hear anything different in that song when Johnny Cash recorded it, different from how you heard it in your head when you wrote it?
Well, he changed some stuff around. That's normal. I do the same thing when I do somebody else's tune. You really have to, you try it on, and if it's a little tighter in here, or it doesn't quite close over this, you cut it, or you know, you make it fit. You want to make it sound like yours.
It's funny because that song, when he sings it, it sounds like it's like an unusual spiritual.
Oh, yeah.
And usually you write about godlessness.
Godlessness, really? Oh.
Wouldn't you say?
I don't know about that.
The absence of God?
I don't know. Do you think so?
Well, some of the songs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of them explicitly, like God's away on business.
Oh, okay. Well, he's away. He's not gone. He's just away. And you have to understand, he was on business. So, you know, and a guy like him has got to be busy, and he's looking after a lot of things. Yeah.
Tom Waits speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. His new CD is called Real Gone. We'll hear more from Tom Waits in the second half of the show. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA Craft, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. And by Gotham Books, publishers of Almost French by Sarah Turnbull, based on the true story of one woman who finds adventure and the love of her life in Paris. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Waits Just a Little Bit Longer. We'll listen back to a 1988 interview with Tom Waits. He has a new album called Real Gone. Plus, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the presidential debates.
Long way going to get my medicine. Sky's the autumn gray of a lonely rain. Piano from a window play. Gone tomorrow, gone yesterday.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. We've been listening to a 2002 interview with Tom Waits. Now let's hear a little of Terry's 1988 conversation with him. He'd just made the performance film Big Time, in which he appeared as several different characters. Terry asked him about one of them, Vegas lounge singer Buddy Greco.
Well, you know, I should play a couple of Vegas homages that you do here. I mean, this is, I think of this as your homage to Frank Sinatra and to showbiz anthems.
A lot of people think that is Frank Sinatra.
Oh, singing on it, really?
Yeah, straight to the top. A friend of mine was in the car with his mom and put on the tape, and she went, gee, is that a new Frank Sinatra song? And she was dead serious.
Well, you know, I really like the song. I mean, it seems to me that it's more of an homage than a parody. Do you know what I mean? I think it's a good song.
Oh, why, thank you.
You do think of that way, too? I mean, I don't read it as a parody as much as... tell me what you think.
Tell you what I think about what?
About your song, Straight to the Top.
Well, that's one of those... one of those phrases that just keeps you going.
Okay.
It's like Big Time. You know? It's like... You gotta have a plan in this world, you know. You gotta have some place you want to go so you know when you've arrived. And Straight to the Top is just one of those songs.
I've put together a little medley of Straight to the Top and I'll Take New York so we can hear a little bit of both of them.
Boy, thank you.
Hey. Somebody's got to put showbiz medleys together, right?
Yeah.
So let's give it a listen. And this is this is in the movie Big Time, but we're going to play it from the album Frank's Wild Years. And this is Tom Waits.
I'm going straight to the top. Whoa. I'm going where the air is fresh and clean. I'm going straight up to the top. If you know me, you know what I mean. I can't let Mr. Sorrow try and pull old Frankie down. We'll live for tomorrow. I found you straight to the top. I'm going up where the air is fresh and clean.
Tom Waits, I have to say, when you do this in the movie, there's something very Liza about it, very Liza Minnelli, like in New York, New York.
oh, yeah. Thank you.
You know, with your arm gestures, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I get a lot of that type of thing. People think that we're not going out anymore, but she gave me a lot.
Well, here's my fantasy about your voice, that you initially sang hoarse because you liked it stylistically, and then you ended up with a really hoarse voice.
You mean like if you cross your eyes, they'll stay that way? when your mom says, don't turn your eyelids inside out, Bobby.
I guess not unlike that, yes. Mm-hmm. So that's my fantasy. What's the reality?
I don't know. I guess when I was a little kid, I used to try to make my voice lower. Because I wanted to grow up real fast so I could be an old man and play golf. You know, I couldn't wait to get there, wear wild slacks and drink coffee and smoke cigars and talk about finance. And it happened very, very fast. You know, when I started talking like this, you know, there I saw the clubs. They appeared in the corner of the room. And so, I don't know. I guess you get the voice you deserve.
Are you taking better care of your voice now? I read that you'd given up smoking.
Uh-huh.
And that's really hard to do. So you must have really been committed to doing it.
I am committed to doing it. I drink my own urine, and I think that's...
that's enough for your voice, right?
It's not bad with a little ice and a twist.
This is the doctor's recommendation, no doubt.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can, you know, I still have a falsetto. It's somewhere around here.
You want to demonstrate that for us?
Well, that's going to cost you.
Right, okay. I want to give our listeners a sense of what you were doing earlier in your career and the kinds of stories and songs that you would do based on what you'd seen in diners and in bars. This is from an early album of yours called Nighthawks at the Diner.
Mm. I was always kind of one who'd like to consider myself kind of a pioneer of the palate, a restaurateur, if you will. I've wined, dined, sipped, and supped in some of the most demonstrably Beamer epitomable bistros in the Los Angeles metropolitan region. Yeah, I've had strange-looking patty melts at Norm's. I've had dangerous veal cutlets at the Copper Penny. Well, what you get is a breaded Salisbury steak and a shake and bake and topped with a provocative sauce of Velveeta and half and half. Smothered with Campbell's tomato soup. See, I had kind of a... I ordered my veal cutlet, Christ, it left the plate and it walked down the end of the counter. Waitress named Irene, boy, she wearing those rhinestone glasses with a little pearl thing clip on a sweater. My veal cutlet come down, try to beat the shit out of my cup of coffee, but coffee just wasn't strong enough to defend itself.
Tom Waits from the 1975 recording Nighthawks at the Diner Asylum. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1988 and again in 2002. We'll hear more from that recent interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Waits has a new CD out called Real Gone. Terry spoke with him in 2002.
What are some of the things that scared you as a kid, either that scared you in real life or movies or music that you found frightening? Interesting, but frightening.
Oh, I don't know. I guess like the plastic covers on sofas always scares me. The sound that makes when you sit down on a sofa that's covered with plastic crinkles. And I don't know. I used to watch Alfred Hitchcock and The Twilight Zone. Those captivated me. Those little tales.
Monster movies.
And monster movies, yeah, sure. But you know, things that really scared me, I don't know. I guess, you know, I could conjure up just about anything and scare myself. You know. If I heard a sound at night, you know, and then it would get larger and larger and stranger and stranger, and I would get, you know, afraid to get out of bed. And I think I had some kind of a disorder, you know, the way I heard things. If I moved my hand across in the air, I heard like, whoo, you know.
Wow, really?
And cars going by sounded like planes. And yeah, very small sounds in the house got enormous. But I think it was just a temporary condition.
Did you ever see a doctor about it?
They said they couldn't help me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What was your first instrument?
I don't know. I don't know. Probably a box or something.
But, I mean, the first instrument.
Oh, my dad gave me a guitar when I was about 9, and, you know, I learned El Paso, and, actually, I learned it in Spanish, because he wouldn't purchase any you know, like English speaking records. He didn't like them. In fact, I remember going
this
by.
This was your father, yeah.
It's my dad, yeah. Went by a stop sign once. There was a guy in a hot rod with you know, with a duck tail and everything, greased down here, comb way back, and he's gunning the motor, and we're in the station wagon, and he looked over at that guy like, you know. And then he looked over at me, and as if to say, "Don't get any ideas," you know. So I had a guitar. I learned 3 chords. I thought I knew everything, and it kind of grew from there.
Now, you dropped out of high school. Why did you drop out? Is there something that you want to do instead, or did you just hate going?
Oh, I wanted to go into the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, enough of this.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like the ceiling in the rooms. I didn't like the holes in the ceiling, the little tiny holes and the corkboard and the long stick used for opening the windows.
Oh, God. Yeah, we had one of those in my elementary school.
I just hated all that stuff. I was real sensitive to my visual surroundings, and I just wanted to get out of there.
Did any adults try to stop you, either your parents or teachers?
I had good teachers. I had some. My folks broke up when I was about 11, and so I had teachers that I liked a lot. I kind of looked up to, and but then they seemed like they couldn't wait to get out into the world themselves and do some, you know, banging around and learning and growing, and so I thought maybe they were encouraging me to leave.
So did you succeed in kind of getting out into the world, so to speak?
Pretty much, yeah. And,
what'd you do?
Oh, yeah, I hitchhiked all over the place, and, yeah, I don't know.
What's the craziest ride that you got when you were hitchhiking that you would shudder to think about now?
Actually, I had some good things that happened to me hitchhiking, because I did wind up on New Year's Eve in front of a Pentecostal church. And an old woman named Mrs. Anderson came out to the... was stuck in a town with, like, 7 people in this town, and trying to get out, you know. And my buddy and I were out there for hours and hours and hours, getting colder and colder. And it was getting darker and darker. And finally, she came over. She says, "Come on into the church here. Where, you know, it's warm, and there's music, and you can sit in the back row." And we did. And... they were singing, and you know, they had a tambourine, electric guitar, and a drummer, and they were, you know, talking in tongues, and then they kept gesturing to me and my friend Sam. I said, "These are our wayfaring strangers here," and so we felt kind of important, and they took up a collection, they gave us some money, bought us a hotel room and a meal, and We got out the next morning, and we hit the first ride, 7 in the morning, and we were gone. It was really nice. I still remember all that, and it was gave me a good feeling about traveling.
Uh-huh. Did you ever do the street musician thing?
I didn't, but when I see people do it, I see, oh, man, I should have done that. That's how you really get your chops together, you know? Because I'm real, I guess, particular about, how, you know, those things. I get real nervous. But I think I wish I had done that, because it looks like it takes a lot of guts, and I think that you probably cut through a lot of potential stage fright that you would eventually have, and then maybe help you down the road.
So has stage fright been an issue for you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I go through all kinds of stuff about it. But, you know, when I get out there, I'm all right.
So the bad part is thinking about going out.
Yeah. And, but my first gigs, my first big gigs are opening the show for Frank Zappa, and I think that was difficult. I was kind of like the rectal thermometer for the audience, and it was a little awkward for me. I was alone, and I was performing in front of large groups of people, and they were verbally abusive, and I think it, I'm like a dog. I was beat as a dog. So,
is there a point in your career that you see as a turning point from getting to where you are now from where you were when you started performing?
Oh yeah, probably. Well, I got married, really. You know? That was it. You know? I mean, that's like the most important thing I ever did. And then Kathleen really was the one that encouraged me to produce my own records. You know. And,
mm-hmm. What kind of music background is she from?
I don't know. Oh, she's got like opera in there, and she was going to be a nun, you know. So we changed all that.
Yeah, I guess so.
But you know, she's adventurous, you know, and she kind of picks up a lot of stations that I don't pick up. I get kind of narrow and concerned in making something, give it four legs and getting it to stand up. And she's more interested in what goes inside, and which is very feminine. And I think that's what works. And the idea of going into the studio and doing your own record is kind of scary. You know, pick the engineer, pick all the musicians, and you know, write some kind of mission statement for yourself and what you want it to be and sound like and feel like, and take responsibility for everything that goes on the tape. That's a lot to do, especially, it's a lot for a record company to let you do when you behave like I did. And they thought I was, I think they thought I was a drunk, and they, you know, and I was really non-communicative, and I scratched the back of my neck a lot, and I looked down at my shoes a lot, and I, you know, and I wore old suits, and they were nervous about me. It's understandable. And in those days, they didn't really let artists produce themselves. That was also the day of the producer, you know, the big shining producer who was like, I guess like the director on a film. They give you the money and they say, go make a record with this guy over here. See what you can get out of him. But once I got a taste for it, I really, really liked it.
Tom Waits, thank you so much. It's really been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Oh, we're all done.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nice to talk to you, Terry.
Tom Waits speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. His new CD is called Real Gone. Here's another track from it called Dead and Lovely.
She was a middle-class girl. She was in over her head. She thought she could stand up in the deep end. He had a bulletproof smile. He had money to burn. She thought she had the moon in her pocket. But now she's dead. She's so dead. forever dead and love me now.
Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on the presidential debates. This is Fresh Air. The second presidential debate is tonight. This time, the candidates will field questions from a selected audience of uncommitted voters. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, says that if debates are the only chance we get to hear the candidates think on their feet, the town hall format of tonight's debate might be the ultimate test.
In the build-up to last week's presidential debate, nobody could resist comparing it to a sporting event. The only question was which. Chris Matthews called it the Big Casino. Joe Scarborough described it as Sammy Sosa versus Pedro Martinez, and Andrea Mitchell was one of about 31 commentators who compared it to the Super Bowl. On CNN, Robert Novak said that Bush can play little ball, but Kerry has to hit a home run, while Al Sharpton reminded Kerry to cut the ring off and make him fight. But the most apt sporting comparison is probably to Olympic figure skating, a quadrennial competition that nobody has any idea how to score unless one of the competitors actually falls down. If you listened only to the media talk about the debates, it could be hard to tell them from an American Idol episode. Over the years, the proportion of post-debate coverage devoted to discussions of the issues has dropped to around 10%. The pundits dissect each twitch and frown for the impact it might have had on the ordinary folks who will be chewing it over at the water coolers the next day. Party spokesmen hype the rhetorical skills of their opponents with the implication that the viewing public is easily taken in by debating gimmicks. You'd think the viewing public would be insulted by that, except that we don't really think it applies to us. We all consider ourselves wise to the play of appearances. And when we finally make up our collective mind about the winner 2 or 3 days later, nobody's sure what the criteria were, apart from that mysterious business of who looked presidential to the voters. As it happens, that phrase first became common in the American political lexicon in the 1970s when the televised debate was permanently revived after a 16-year lull and when the networks first began broadcasting post-debate commentary and spin. Looking presidential in debates is like artistic merit in figure skating, an imponderable that nobody feels obliged to pin down. High-minded people tend to grumble that the rules are set up to turn the confrontations into beauty contests rather than what they call real debates. Shortly after the Kennedy-Nixon debates, Henry Steele Commager wrote that the format privileges the glib, the evasive, the dogmatic, and the melodramatic over the sincere, the judicious, the sober, and the honest. But actually, what the critics mean by a real debate isn't much like what goes on at the Oxford Union or a high school debate club. It's more like a serious back-and-forth discussion of the issues where each candidate would lay out his views on whether China should be included in the negotiations with North Korea, and then the public could make up its own mind who was right. But the fact is that the debates are about the only occasion we have to watch the candidates thinking on their feet. True, what they're mostly thinking about is which canned response to substitute for an answer. But there's an art to that, too. The elaborate rules the parties set up in advance can only determine what kind of talk show the debate is going to be. In the end, the candidates are going to be evaluated according to how well they perform as guests. And in that department, we viewers are as knowledgeable as a figure skating judge who's giving points for a triple axel. And the debates are undeniably informative, even if they don't leave us much clearer on the issues. As Alan Schroeder remarked in his History of the Presidential Debates, no matter how the deck has been stacked, little arrows of verisimilitude managed to shoot out of the screen. The format of last Thursday's debate may have been chosen to minimize the risk to the candidates, but it also happened to create a setting that discouraged grandstanding and condescension. Even if the answers were ultimately aimed at the viewing audience, they had to be framed as if they were addressed to Jim Lehrer, which required a certain modulation of tone. A candidate can't respond to a question with the jabs and one-liners that he uses to work the crowd at campaign rallies. It would feel the way it does when a comic tries to converse with Leno or Letterman in nightclub shtick. As it happens, that format neutralized a lot of the techniques that have made the president so effective when he's speaking to his supporters. The sarcasm that brings the listeners in on the joke, the rising pauses that seem to ask for a response from the audience. Even if we couldn't see Jim Lehrer's reactions, we know he wouldn't have gone there. And it was striking that Kerry came off so well without following the pundit's advice to avoid complexity and reveal his lighter side. True, he was a bit crisper than usual, but his sentences were still a lot longer than Bush's, and he kept ticking off points on his fingers. And apart from a kindly quip about Bush's daughters, he was all business. This may all play very differently in the town hall format of tonight's debate, where the audience will be an active force in the room, and where the setting's more congenial to elaborate demonstrations of feeling people's pain. Even so, neither of these two candidates is going to be able to keep viewers from taking their measure. We're at least as skillful at watching talk shows as they are at appearing on them.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and the author of Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Fred Snyder, Joyce Lieberman, and John Knapp. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive director of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delacorte Press, publisher of Da Vinci Decoded, Discovering the Spiritual Secrets of Leonardo's Seven Principles by Michael J. Gelb, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Philip Roth. Roth has won the Pulitzer Prize, the Penn Faulkner Award, and two National Book Awards for his novels, which include The Human Stain, American Pastoral, and Portnoy's Complaint. His new novel is called The Plot Against America. Join us for the next Fresh Air.